is CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor. Here's John Batchelor.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor, and I welcome Foundation for the Defense of Democracy senior fellows Bill Raggio and Tom Joslin to comment on the present in Afghanistan and the future with al-Qaeda. Gentlemen, a very good day to you. Bill, I start with you because your report about 8 more districts or 10 more districts or 12 more districts to the Taliban. What does this look like now, Bill? And can you discern a plan here? Good day to you.
Good evening, John. Yesterday I actually woke up and wrote a report. 6 districts fell over the course of a week. And then this morning I wake up and 2 more districts fall to the Taliban. Districts, think of them as counties here in the United States. And it didn't just happen where people would expect it to be in the South or the East, where the Taliban, that's the traditional Taliban strongholds where they are their toughest. It happened in the South. It happened in the Southeast. It happened in the North. It happened in the West. And even in a district in central Afghanistan that wasn't even contested, that was a district that just collapsed overnight. The Taliban, what I think they're trying to do is keep the Afghan military pinned down everywhere. So that they can't concentrate their forces and take on the Taliban, say in the South and the East, where the Taliban have a lot of strength, and where I think you have 3 provincial capitals that are preparing to fall in Kandahar, Oruzgan, and Helmand. I think the Taliban's ultimate goal, take the South, take the East, fight in the other areas, keep Afghan security forces tied down. And they're after taking South and East, they're going to want to take Kabul and do it as quick as possible. This is what I see, as is what the Taliban seem poised to do this. One of the more interesting things that I've been noticing, John, about all of this, one of the more disturbing things is the Taliban really isn't gloating about its victories as it has in the past over the Afghan security forces. Now I'm just starting to see it looks like all business for the Taliban. I think they sense that they're winning. They've won politically and they're winning on the battlefield. And I think they could smell victory now, and they're going for it. They're putting their heads down and taking it to Afghan security forces. In many of these districts that collapsed, the Afghan security forces just withdrew rather than fight it out with the Taliban. That's a really bad sign. And one of the questions I get asked a lot, John, is, when do I think this collapse will happen? And I can't predict that. It could, the way things are happening right now, it could be a month. It could be 6 months. It could be a year. It all depends on if the Afghan security forces and Afghan government can get it together and decide where it wants to make its final stand.
Bill, is there any indication that the prisoners that the Taliban necessarily takes here and there from the Afghan national forces, is there any indication that they're being treated well or badly? Is there a plan to deal with, in the event there's a collapse, how are they going to deal with people who wore the uniform of the army?
Yeah, so the Taliban's policy on this is very clear. Anyone who admits their errors or their ways and promises not to fight against the Taliban, or even better, if they'll join the Taliban ranks, they'll be forgiven. The Taliban call this is their version of reconciliation. I'm sure there's individuals they have a list without a doubt of people who they will never reconcile with. It'll probably be local police commanders, district chiefs, things of that nature, until like guys in the NDS, the Taliban hate them because that's the National Directorate of Security, basically Afghan's version of CIA and FBI rolled up into one. Those guys won't be forgiven. But in general, the average Taliban or average Afghan soldier, average Afghan policeman, average Afghan government worker will be forgiven. That's a way the Taliban can be perceived as being magnanimous. Right now, they don't want to go on a killing spree and sort of like poison this whole thing that they're an actual state and they're a victor.
That suggests that that might explain why the news from the Taliban is that the interpreters don't need to leave because they're showing remorse. That would be consistent with how they're treating the soldiers.
Right. Yes. So the Taliban want with the interpreters to say, you served our enemy, but if you show remorse, as you noted, if you promise not to do this, it's the same exact message. You'll stay. But if you try to leave the country, then you're an actual traitor to Afghanistan. And then they conclude that statement. Actually, Taliban issued a statement on this by saying, hey, then whatever happens to you happens to you. It's not our responsibility.
Tom, you have a report about Haqqani Network and Siraj Haqqani from analyzing a UN report. What do we learn here that you and Bill have not explicated over the years? And what are the results of this present report? Good evening to you, Tom.
Good evening, John. Well, there's this monitoring team that works for the UN Security Council that regularly reports on Al-Qaeda and ISIS and the war in Afghanistan and related matters. And this latest report, which was released earlier this month, provides some new intelligence or cites some new intelligence on concerning these matters. And one of the more intriguing claims that we found in the report is actually referenced in a footnote that says that Sirajuddin Haqqani, who is the deputy emir of the Taliban's Islamic Emirate, so this is the guy who's nominally second in charge of the Taliban's command. We think he's even more important than second in charge because he commands a lot of the forces that are fighting on behalf of the Taliban. Really, even though he's not the military chief, he effectively has served in that role for much of his history. The same guy, who's the number two for the Taliban, is also part of Al-Qaeda's wider leadership. And what that means precisely is not specified in the report. There's some ambiguity here. But it wouldn't be surprising to us at all because there's a huge dossier on Siraj Haqqani and his so-called Haqqani Network, which is a part of the Taliban. And this network really incubated Al-Qaeda in the 1980s and has remained closely allied with Al-Qaeda. They're really blood brothers to this day. So this wouldn't be surprising at all. But it does further undermine the idea that there is some hard distinction to be made between the Taliban and Al-Qaeda. You remember, John, that much of American policy over the past 20 years has hinged on the idea that there is such a distinction between the two. And yet here you have the convergence of the two in one figure.
Siraj Haqqani operates as a significant figure in the Taliban's plans ahead. Do we have any indication, if he's part of the Al-Qaeda leadership, do we have an indication of Al-Qaeda's plans working through Siraj Haqqani after the withdrawal, Tom?
Well, I think it's obvious now, or should be obvious to everybody, that Al-Qaeda is helping Siraj Haqqani and the Taliban consolidate its gains in Afghanistan to resurrect the Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan. This is something Bill and I have been saying for years. And they plan on restoring this emirate as a model for jihadi success. You know, we've documented for now for so many years the jihadi efforts in all these different theaters. And one of the big liabilities they have is that they can very rarely claim victory. ISIS temporarily had a victory in 2013, 2014 when it declared its caliphate. There's some other smaller victories or other victories that can be claimed throughout time, but nothing has been permanent or lasting. And what they want to do, what Al-Qaeda wants to do now is use the restored Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan as basically a boon for the jihadi cause to say, see, we can not only were the Soviets defeated by the Mujahideen the first time around, but now we beat America, the second superpower, the second time around. And so this is the central theme of what's coming out of Afghanistan.
Tom Joslin and Bill Raggio of the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies, they and their colleagues keep the Long War Journal, which is a chronicle of the contest with the jihadists over a vast landscape. We've started in Afghanistan. However, it ranges all across North Africa, all deep into Africa, certainly in the Gulf, and through Asia, through the Al-Qaeda network, reaching even into the subcontinent. And we know it spreads across the map into Southeast Asia. That's all part of the conversation about Al-Qaeda. And Tom and Bill have a podcast I highly recommend, Generation Jihad. And we're going to discuss this week's podcast when we come back to learn more about Hatin Shura, H-A-T-T-I-N, Al-Qaeda's core leadership. What is it? Where is it? And what is its significance now that the U.S. is withdrawing from Afghanistan? This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Boucher. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Boucher. And I'm with the senior fellows for the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies, Bill Raggio and Tom Joslin, who keep the podcast Generation Jihad. I highly recommend it. It's their conversation of the week behind and ahead and what we're learning about the jihadists over this vast landscape, concentrating now most recently on the revelation through the UN and others of the Hatin Shura. This is a way of talking about a leadership council, like a Joint Chiefs of Staff for Al-Qaeda. It's fresh to me, so I'll start with you, Tom, because it's your report that brings this to my attention. And your conversation with Bill is revelatory, because we have to do some speculating here. We don't have a great number of facts. What do we believe it is that Siraj Akhani is part of? But where is the Shura, and what is it up to?
So in passing, in this footnote in passing, the UN Security Council monitoring team mentions the Hatin Shura. This is something I've heard about now for a few years, but the details regarding it have been few to come by and hard to come by. But I've been piecing it together, and basically what I now can report is that Hatin Shura is basically the supreme body within Al-Qaeda. It's the supreme decision-making body. It is part of the reorganization efforts for this group. And, you know, it's one of the surprising things in all this is that after nearly 20 years, there's still a widespread disagreement over even what Al-Qaeda is. And it's widely assumed even that there is no internal organization for Al-Qaeda. That's just all loosely affiliated, and it's all comes down to Ayman al-Zawahiri and very few others. Well, the story I think that's emerging is very different. The Hatin Shura is a centralized body that has a robust bureaucratic organization that is making all the strategic decisions really for Al-Qaeda's global network. And we're told that it's actually led by senior Al-Qaeda leaders inside Iran. So in other words, the Hatin Shura is run out of Iran, including by guys who have been there for many years now.
And the Shura, what would a decision by the Shura mean, look like, Tom, at the geostrategic level? Is this big thing about supplies, ordnance, or is this about attack zones?
You know, it's much more strategic in nature, although, you know, we don't really have insight into all the decisions they're weighing in on. Remember Osama bin Laden, when he was killed by the Navy SEALs in May 2011, was actually weighing in on micro decisions as well. So it's very possible that they're reaching out in a way that's much more micromanaging than people even realize. But the sense that we get is that this Hatin Shura, or advisory council, basically is the central strategic command for Al-Qaeda. It's making strategic decisions for Al-Qaeda. Now, you know, you mentioned to listeners this wide expanse of land which Al-Qaeda and its so-called regional branches are fighting over. And this body makes decisions for all of them. So they're going to weigh in on what's going on in Somalia, what's going on in West Africa, Syria, Yemen, Afghanistan, Pakistan, and elsewhere. And they're going to try and set the agenda for all these different parts of Al-Qaeda.
Bill, in your conversation with Tom, I learned from both of you that the Shura is one way that Al-Qaeda is managing its many iterations so that there's not more breakaways like ISIS. Is that accurate, and has it been successful?
Well, to be clear, we can only speculate that that's one of the reasons. This is one, if you listen to our podcast, one of the things Tom and I are trying to, you know, get across is there's not a lot of understanding throughout the U.S. government and in the wider counterterrorism community of what the Hatin Shura and how it's organized. But it would make a lot of sense given the timing of the establishment of the Hatin Shura at that time. You did have the breakaway faction from the Islamic State. It would make sense that the Hatin Shura would do things like try to keep Al-Qaeda a cohesive organization, try to, you know, determine what the problems within the organization that could cause factions within it to break away, like the Islamic State, I'm sorry, like the Islamic movement in Uzbekistan did in Afghanistan, or some members of the Pakistani Taliban did. That's what formed the Islamic State Khorasan province. And really what happened in Syria has been just a complete mess for Al-Qaeda. So, I mean, to me, one of the biggest decisions that a council like this could do, would be responsible for, was to keep Al-Qaeda together and then also to organize, coordinate its operation across its branches, which would be, of course, Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb, Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, Shabab, which is Al-Qaeda's branch in East Africa, and so on and so on. But there's just been so little work, so little attempt by the wider counterterrorism field to even understand what these issues are. That's what Tom and I are really trying to get across in this podcast.
Tom, in conversation with Bill, you also point to a remark by President of the United States, Mr. Biden, recently about leaving Afghanistan. And I believe the construction is if Al-Qaeda comes back, One more time, Tom. Is this fact that Al-Qaeda has never left Afghanistan nor the region? And is that fact in this UN report, are those all fixed in Washington or are they still up for debate?
No, one of the things, John, that Bill and I have talked about for years now is there's been really an incredible failure of leadership here on all these issues. And it's part of the reason why we're somewhat jaded when discussing all this, because, President Biden in a speech on May 28th said that basically the U.S. was going to guard against Al-Qaeda returning. He said return to Afghanistan. It's not a matter of Al-Qaeda returning to Afghanistan. There's absolutely no basis for saying that they have to return to Afghanistan. We know they're already there. This isn't just the UN reporting, which has come out over this most recent report and a series of other reports. It's also the DIA, that's the Defense Intelligence Agency. The Pentagon is reporting on this. You can see even in the minimal reporting that the Pentagon does, they still recognize Al-Qaeda is there. And you can see in the U.S. Treasury reports, there's just a wealth of evidence, Al-Qaeda's internal reporting. There's just a wealth of evidence that Al-Qaeda is there and operating throughout the country. So it's really framing it that way as that the U.S. is going to guard against the return of Al-Qaeda to Afghanistan, I think just shows just how poorly understood all this is so many years later.
Bill, you report often for me on the U.S. efforts in East Africa. I'm thinking of the airstrikes, which we believe are drone strikes now and again in Somalia and other parts of East Africa, and dealing with Shabaab in East Africa and Central Africa. Have you ever come across the Hattin Shora referenced, some liaison between Shabaab and this council? Have you ever heard it?
We've just seen, as Tom noted, we've heard about this from various individuals we speak to within government, intelligence, military, and there's been some scattered reporting on it out there. But I've never seen anything specifically where the groups themselves are referring to the Hattin Shora. But we do know that, for instance, Shabaab's Amir communicates with Al-Qaeda's global leadership and communicates with other branches. We've seen evidence of
that. Okay.
And we would surmise that, again, the branch leaders probably would be members of the Hattin Shora. So that communication would be evidence of this.
So there'd be liaison. And Tom, is the Shura an idea, a place, a location? Is there such a place as Shura on the map?
Well, Shura means advisory, consultative. It's basically the Arabic word for advisory, consultative. And so the Shura Council is an advisory council that advises the emir and their scheme. And Hattin, which is the name of the Shura, comes from the Battle of Hattin, a very famous 12th century battle in Islamic history in which Muslim forces gathered all these disparate factions together for their one big battle against the Crusaders, which they won. And that's why this Shura is named Hattin, because the idea is that they're going to gather all these forces for the coming new battle against the Crusaders. It's a somewhat ominous name when you know the history here, because it suggests that they're not, in fact, going to give up on coming after the U.S. or Western targets once the U.S. retreats from all these different places, including especially Afghanistan. I think that may be what they're sort of the connotation that they gave it to the name. But in any event, they are absolutely trying to muster their forces across the board for the coming fight.
Tom Joslin, Bill Raggio, senior fellows of the Foundation for the Defense of Democracy, Hattin Shura, Hattin Shura, Al-Qaeda's high command. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor.
You're listening to CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.